Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours. Hello, Pulpeteers, and welcome to Issue 29 of Protecting Project Pulp, the podcast that each week redefines reality, carefully rearranging the details of existence so that the splendid tales of the golden age of pulp fiction are transformed into auditory wine so we can pour them directly into your ears. Yes, we want your ears drunk on pulp fiction. That's kind of our job around here. I'm your host, Dave Robison. Today, dear friends, we are delighted to offer up a special treat, a tale of rare and strange beauty crafted by none other than James Blaylock. The tale is titled The Pink of Fading Neon, and it was first published in issue number 47 of the Tri-Quarterly Journal of Northwestern University in the winter of 1980. The story is copyright 1980 by Master Blaylock and presented here with his kind permission. James Blaylock is one of a trio of mad geniuses who have blazed a delightful trail across genre fiction. With his inspired companions Tim Powers and K.W. Jeter, Blaylock helped pioneer some astonishing new paths in the specfic wilderness. In particular, the steampunk genre owes him a debt of gratitude. Now, I could certainly wax rhapsodic about Master Blaylock's history and achievements, as I am wont to do, but today I will forego my usual foray into foundational events, because today we have the singular pleasure of sharing with you an interview with the man himself, conducted by PPP's own editor, Fred Heimbaugh. In it, James eloquently expands upon such topics as the steampunk genre, his pulp fiction influences, and his latest novel, The Aylesford Skull. It begins almost immediately after the story, so keep those earbuds firmly embedded, will you? Now, your narrator for this descent into fabulosity is also Fred Heimbaugh. Fred, in addition to being the assistant editor here at Protecting Project Pulp, has been a frequent contributor to the Hugo Award-winning podcast Starship Sofa as a book and graphic novel reviewer and a songwriter. Fred's latest song, Abraham Lincoln Was an Invader from Space, can be heard on YouTube and is available for purchase, along with other of Fred's sci-fi musical creations, at Amazon and iTunes. And you can follow Fred on Twitter under the handle Fredosphere. Now, you know, there are patterns in the world that not everyone sees. Perception is the first step of awareness, but it's also the first unraveling thread of madness.
There has been a good deal of dark weather here lately, although I'm not at all sure whether it is actual dark weather or simply the absence of something or other. I sometimes suspect the latter. But it is dark. Clouds overhead thick enough to be invisible. Just a dim gray and a mist of fog floating over the bay and now and then stealing ashore. There was moss, or perhaps fungus, on my shoes again this morning. It appeared to be a moist gray-green fuzz, but brushed away like dust. It means, I suppose, that the colors are fading, a thing I have long suspected. Away to the north, beyond the tower, is what appears to be, is, in fact, a market. An arabesque of letters, part gone, shines in bright neon pink, like a mythological flamingo that glows through the gray days, an impossible swamp bird that can stand all day on a single leg. The sign itself is inane, but throws that roseate glow over the stilt legs of the tower. A water tower, they say, which sprang up in two evenings, three great legs with a cone atop, and has sat there since, for the most part, with dandelions and fuchsias sprouting about the base. And leering beyond, half hidden behind a fence, once red, but now gray and dark and falling, day by day, to bits, squats an elongated metal sphere, toad-like in the weeds. Little windows hung with the tatters of curtains and neat rows of rivets in the steel skin make it appear terrestrial. But a quaint sign, a puff of wind blow altogether alien lowercase letters which spell out the word Airstream in frightful clarity, makes it appear something else altogether. The implication startled me at first. They should startle anyone. And I was curious that no passerby on the sidewalk below were similarly startled. There was a time, in fact, not a long time to be sure, I'm a clever sort of chap, that the thing in the weeds seemed nothing but a tow-along home which, when attached to the rear of an automobile, would pursue it along the highway. But the thing appeared one evening, sailing, bubble-like. I glimpsed it passing across the mouth of an alley on Second Street, with nothing resembling an automobile attached to either end. I'll condescend to swear to it. A swirl of fog from the bay, wet with the smell of seaweed and tar, whirled along in its wake as if the thing itself were a leaking container of mists from some vast and lonely sea. And speaking of weather, it occurs to me when I recall my youth that coupling sunshine and childhood in our minds is not, as the psychologists tell us, a symbolic confusion of objects and ideas about objects in our subconscious. It is actuality itself. The weather was more pronounced then, rain or shine. It hadn't this gray mediocrity about it. I've heard and read, and it doesn't surprise me a bit, that the armadillos have turned back. After eons of slow northward creeping from the plains of Central America, through the jungles and the swamps and the deserts of Mexico, while woolly mammoths and cave bears crashed through the chaparral, and still, ages later, while Aztec and Toltec tribes lived in fear of loathsome toad-infested pits of skeletons in rainwater, on came the armadillos. On the march for 20 million years, and culminating in unimaginable pairs of shoes and ridiculous scaled and tailed caps. All of that has reversed in an instant. Up and down the flatlands of Oklahoma, say the scientists, armadillos pause and listen and sniff the air and turn calmly about. On the march south now, once again. But, as I say, it surprises me not at all. I read about it in a journal of scientific discovery, and it fit well. like a pair of shoes. My own shoes, simulated alligator, could barely have been seen this morning for the moss on them. They appeared amphibian. Anyway, I hadn't gotten beyond the first paragraph, the armadillos having barely conceived of the plan for the tremendous northward push into, over eons, civilization. When there came a knock at the door, it was my neighbor, Monroe. His chin, it seemed, was gone. It had never amounted to much, and now it was even less a chin, more a row of teeth, which his lower lip couldn't quite conceal. Monroe seemed to be disappearing. He was consuming himself. His eyes had been drawn into his head in search, no doubt, for his chin. But his nose had been pulled out like an armadillo's, and his ears hung in a sheet like those of a ring-laden African princess, and he had shrunk by several inches. The spine, they say, although made of bone, which should last as well as the rest of us, is the first to go. Monroe was becoming a dwarf. It was clear, and not unrelated, I suspect, to the shining, spheroid, airstream thing in the weeds. In Monroe's weeds, a thing Monroe used to tow about behind an automobile, an incredible Hudson of ludicrous make, with an insect name, and with great black balloons for tires. But during the years that the automobile has gone to bits, in much the same way as its master, the little starship of an airstream waited in the weeds and was joined in time by what appeared at first to be a water tower, sprung up in 2 days on great gangling stilts, jointed at the knees. Monroe, a dwarf, through no fault of his own, in gray flannel, or what seemed superficially gray flannel, had always tottered past, morning after morning, his eyes sucking inward with his chin, his nose, and ears, succumbing to the forces of gravity and stretching, beak-like and flap-like, groundward. He pattered northward up the sidewalk to the market. It was his constitutional. Along went Monroe through years of shrinking until that one morning when I, having barely begun with the armadillos, heard a tapping on the door. It was sharp, yet faint, so that I listened a moment in dread. It was a skeleton's knock. Hard knuckles, but with no muscle left in the arm to wield them. Just a sort of clack, clack, clack that bamboo wind chimes might make in a breeze muffled by gray morning mists. But the clack, clack, clack came again, and I gave up my armadillos and opened the door a crack, anxious, as you can easily understand, to keep the fog and the smell of seaweed and tar outside. But that, too, was futile, and the mists crept in with an eye to my shoes, which I had, just that morning, wiped clean with newspaper. There was Monroe, squinting, failing to recognize me, failing even to recognize the very sidewalk beneath his feet. Across the road, Monroe's house was enveloped in fog, fog that swirled around the sphere in the weeds, in and out of the windows, blowing the tatters of ragged curtains, fossil curtains, outward into the air. Monroe couldn't speak. Monroe couldn't see well enough to recognize me. And if he could see, that is, he wouldn't have known me anyway. Monroe, it appeared, was lost. lost, just half a block from home and half a block from the market. Monroe, I said, thinking to alert him in some telling way. What? He looked about him. Monroe was lost. He was befuddled. He blinked his eyes very slowly like a chameleon, as if giving the problem a really solid bit of thought. He took pause, as they say. Then he shuffled about in a little half-circle, a slow and painstaking about-face, and with my finger as an indicator, tottered south toward home, the market. The whole idea of markets. Abandoned. That was some time ago, and since then, there has been no Monroe. His house, it seems, remains perpetually fog enshrouded, and I'm sure that from the vantage point of Monroe's window, my own would seem the same. Monroe is still in there. Dead, likely, as a doornail, and in 20 years, after the last of the armadillos has flown out of Texas, Monroe will still be dead in that gray house, a bit of dust and hair, shrunk beyond time and reason, but no more dead than he is now. The exact relation between the sphere in the weeds, the water tower, and the seaweed fog that enclosed Monroe's house, not to mention Monroe himself, is puzzling. I admit that, at one time, I suspected the very nature of water towers, which I thought to be storage tanks. But now, in my research, I find that they have something to do with equalizing this and that. That they are essential. Most of our mechanisms are essential. Monroe's sphere is somehow essential. But the tower across the road is merely a silver cone atop stilts. It could house an army of aliens as easily as 100,000 gallons of water, and no one, I fear, would care to know. It is attached to nothing at all. There are no pipes or hoses. You'll say, I've read too much Wells, and I am frightened of tripods. And that may be so. You can say what you like. I know what I know. I mentioned having glimpsed the airstream across the mouth of an alley off Second Street, not far, in fact, from the Vance Hotel. And you will agree by now that it could not have been Monroe who motored it about. But just yesterday evening, upstairs, in the library, I sat reading. It was late, very late, and there was a good fog coming in off the ocean. The curtains on the windows are lace, rather sad lace, I fear, gone from white to gray with the years. A pink thread of neon shone along the sill, and the night outside was cold and dim, and a deep, resonant, lowing sound muttered in from the bay. A foghorn, I hope. I nodded there in front of the electric fire, something entitled The Story of Our Earth, open in my hand, when I heard the faint but sharp tap, tap, tapping. That skeletal rapping somewhere out in the night. Noises in the night tend to make one start more violently, I suppose, than the same noises would in the light of day. My book tumbled to the floor, and I rose, thinking first of horrors, then of Monroe, but I recalled quickly that I was in among the shadows of bookcases on the second floor, and the tap, there it was again, was at the window. Could Monroe? I thought. But no, Monroe was a dwarf. Monroe was gone altogether. And I peered out into the dim night, ere a swirl with mist. In the pink of neon there glinted for the briefest of moments an arc of silver, the bent joint of a single still leg wobbling momentarily, clacking once more against the window pane, then disappearing in the fog, away toward the sea. I squinted out at Monroe's house. The little airstream sphere glowed in the moonlight, or perhaps through fog-filter neon, which had mysteriously pierced the thick mists. And the mist swirled deeper, obscuring the field of fuchsia and dandelion, fading telephone poles. The airstream shuddered and, it seemed to me then, rose from its nesting place and followed in the wake of the striding tower toward the bay. It sounds, I know, very much like a madness. But so what? What do I care for madness? What struck me as insidious was the fact that next morning, in the dim sun of coastal autumn, both had returned and sat placid as herons among their respective weeds. And what is true about mechanisms is that as we move from the Jurassic age of technology toward some ultimate goal, relentlessly like armadillos, and all one day likely to be made into preposterous hats or scaled croquet balls, all our devices become simpler and grayer, and their function becomes less clear. They become primitive and bestial and even prehistoric in the most roundabout way. What must it have been like when the earth was all ocean? When there was nothing but monsters? Imagine yourself, another Professor Hardwig, afloat on gray Paleozoic seas where, 20 feet beneath the surface, unbelievable whales and amphibious beasts tear at each other and then disappear into the mouths of dim, primordial caves. Chambered cephalopods and trilobites and sea snails as great as Monroe's airstream creep sluggishly about the dim reefs amid the rubbery stalks and bladders of seaweeds. Imagine yourself afloat on a pitching wooden raft in a prehistoric age, a million years before the first armadillos would decide among themselves to wander north out of Mayan jungles toward the sunlight and open spaces. That same gray atmosphere, trust me, born again of seaweed and oceans, washes in night by day, drawn by the moon as surely as the tides, and amid fuchsias and dandelions, monsters lie humped and waiting, striding off by night in the mists. And each morning, gray mold covers my shoes and sprouts from the walls, along with, doubtless, the germinating seeds of tiny trilobites and nautili. My clothing, as well as my shoes, is becoming gray felt, just as Monroe's did. All this is not madness. The armadillos have turned back, to the grand amazement of science. And so, I fear, has everything else. And the pink of fading neon, what are they up to? That is what is unclear. That they come and go in the night along fog-enshrouded avenues and beneath pale lunar rays is a certainty. But I'm not an impatient man. If the thing has knocked once on the window pane, it will knock again.
You just heard The Pink of Fading Neon by James Blaylock, read by Fred Heimbaugh. It's always a delight to discover unique and engaging tales, but for me at least, it's even more intriguing to explore the minds and perceptions of the authors who craft these marvelous stories. And this week, we do exactly that. So, dear friends, sit back and enjoy this wonderful conversation with James Blaylock.
Welcome, Pulpsters. This is Fred Heimbaugh. I'm the editor of Protecting Project Pulp. Normally, I'm in the background. But today, it is my singular privilege and pleasure to be interviewing a very special guest for the podcast. James Paul Blaylock is an American fantasy author famous for coining the term steampunk. He was born in Long Beach, California, and studied English at California State University, Fullerton, receiving a master's degree in 1974, and he lives in Orange, California, teaching creative writing at Chapman University. He and his friends Tim Powers and K.W. Jeter were mentored by Philip K. Dick. Along with Powers, he invented the poet William Ashbluss. Blaylock and Powers have often collaborated with each other on writing stories. James Blaylock is also the director of the Creative Writing Conservatory at the Orange County High School of the Arts, where Powers is writer in residence. Blaylock has twice won the World Fantasy Award for Best Short Fiction, once for 13 Phantasms in 1997, and once for Paper Dragons in 1986. Jim, welcome to the Protecting Project Pulp podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
And we are very happy to have you on. And in my introduction, I described you as a fantasy author, but it might be more precise to say that you write magical realism. Is that a fair statement? And how do you feel about those kinds of labels?
Well, you know, I guess I'm not really crazy about labels of any sort, because they seem to first be created by reviewers and literary critics after the fact. And they seem to be far too convenient for me. Ways that a reviewer, for example, might kickstart an article without having to say anything more crucial, more accurate, I guess. Also, I you know, because I've taught at the university now for, God help me, coming up on 40 years, I that can't be true, but coming close, I guess, 35 years, let's say. I'm really suspicious of any jargon that academic writers might toss around, and I think magic realism is one of those. So, yeah, I guess I'm not crazy about being labeled, because it seems to be a little bit too limiting. On the other hand, magic realism is a really okay term among literary scholars, and consequently, in that aspect of my life, I suppose I'm willing to claim to be that thing. Does that make sense?
Completely. So you're saying it's a convenience that can become a crutch, or is a sign of kind of lazy thinking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I'm willing to profit from the term if there's profit in it.
Well, you created the term steampunk, and
actually, I'm sorry to interrupt. K.W. Jeter actually coined that term in a letter to Locus magazine in, I think, 1988. Mm-hmm. That wasn't me.
Oh, I see.
I was, you know, if I have any claim to fame in between or among K.W. Jeter, Tim Powers, and I, it was that I was fortunate enough to publish the first domestic steampunk story in Unearthed magazine back in 1978. And at that time, K.W. was engaged in writing a novel, a steampunk novel called Morlock Knight. But because it was a longer work and longer in production at the publishing company, it didn't actually see print until 1979, a few months after my story came out. So I'm happy to say that I published the first domestic steampunk piece, but KW actually coined the term 10 years later in a letter to Locus magazine.
Well, I'm glad you set the record straight, because that's the last thing I would want to do is add to the noise of misinformation in the world.
Yeah, well, KW is living down in Ecuador currently, so he can't easily get at me to strangle me if I make those kinds of claims. But yeah, might as well keep it straight.
Yes. Now, you knew Tim Powers in college, but you've obviously stayed in close contact. We interviewed him back in episode 14 of this podcast. So if any listener missed that and wants to go back and look it up, I definitely would urge them to do that. Tim Powers told us about your mutual friend, William Ashbless. And he told us quite a few stories about Mr. Ashbless, but I'd love to hear your side of the story on that.
Okay. I'm assuming that, in fact, I'm pretty sure that whatever Tim told you is entirely accurate. And I guess I'll preface this by saying that that in that particular era, the end of the 60s there and in the early 70s, it was a really good time to be in school, especially as a literature major, because literature majors can get very good grades simply by making crap up. I hate to say that, but I'm still a literary guy, and it's as true today as it was back in those days. And also, you know, the war had wound down, and there were excuses not to go to class that were not as, just leave it at that. And we tended to have a certain amount of free time on our hands, and we got usually met each other in the school commons in the morning and ate breakfast and considered whether we'd actually attend class. In fact, Tim was infamous at the school for having taken a literature class. There were no attendance policies at the time. He took a literature class, and I believe the history of the English language, in which he attended the first day of class, the midterm exam day, and the final exam day, and got an A in the class, which irritated the professor no end, but made Tim a sort of, he was heroic for having pulled that off. Anyway, we were sitting around in the commons eating eggs and bacon one morning and reading the school newspaper, and there was some moderately, bad poetry published in it. Not that we were monumental critics ourselves in those days, but we could spot pretty crappy poetry when we saw it. And Tim said, essentially, we can do worse than that, in his exact words. And he pulled out a piece of paper and he wrote a line of poetry on it. And I believe the line was, "The horse flies that dress me each morning." And he handed it to me, and I wrote a line and I handed it back, and he wrote a line, and we came up with a poem that was maybe 15, 20 lines long. And we found that so amusing that we made up some rules. One rule was that the poetry could not ever focus on anything, that it had to be utterly meaningless, and that if it began to seem to be meaningful, we would change the course of the poem. The second thing was that it had to be, that it was a good thing if it were full of lunatic literary illusions. And so we spent most of that morning writing more poetry. We needed a name for the poets, so we made up the name William Ashbless, and we turned five of the poems into the school newspaper, putting it in the box without being seen, with a note saying that that it was written by William Ashbless, who was mildly hideously deformed, couldn't be seen in public, but would be happy if was a student at the school, which was a lie, and of course they never checked. And we left my telephone number as a contact number. And a few days later, I was my wife and I were eating dinner, and the telephone rang, and I picked it up, and it was, or I think my wife picked it up anyway, actually. And the voice asked if William Ashbless was at home, and she rolled her eyes and handed me the phone. And I got on and assured him that I was William Ashbless, that everything we had written in the letter was true, and I made up a bunch of goofy stuff. I assured him that I was not a crazy person, which I think is always always a nice thing to assure people if they have any doubts. Yeah, so Tim and I continued to write the poetry until finally the third edition that published our poetry, when we read it, we decided that we were going to push it to the limit. And so we wrote a poem called A Day at the Farm that contained a lot of lyrics from the song Old MacDonald's Farm. And it was so idiotic that I think the newspaper realized that they were being hosed, basically. Oh. Yeah, and that was the end of the publishing at that time. We continued to read the poetry at the Fullerton Poetry Society. And then for one reason and another, we included old bearded poets named William Ashbless in the stuff that we were writing. And the Folly Press up in Seattle contacted us to ask if they could publish a William Ashbless poem. And one thing led to another, and finally William Ashbless was writing poetry that was being published by deluxe presses like Cheap Street Press, for example. And
I assume that by that time the cat was out of the bag.
The cat was only beginning to come out of the bag at that time. We'd done some signings locally in which people brought in William Ashbless stuff for us to sign. But when Cheap Street proposed a sort of a joint Ashbless project, they were unaware of the fact that the cat was out of the bag. And they did 100 little pamphlets on very high-quality handmade paper, handset type, et cetera, et cetera, for the World Fantasy Convention, I believe, in 1986, when I won the World Fantasy Award for Paper Dragons. And Tim and I were instructed to take... We could keep 50 of the copies, and the other 50 we were supposed to simply surreptitiously lay around at the World Fantasy Convention. And I remember that we laid a bunch around and then came in later after a big function was over and noticed that heaps of them had simply been tossed into the trash, you know.
Oh, no.
Which was fairly hilarious. We dug some out, and it could be that there are 40, 30, 25 copies of that out there in the hands of collectors nowadays. But I bet there's not too many more of that. I still have a pile. I think Tim's got a pile somewhere, God knows where. But yeah, it was funny. And then he appeared in Tim's book, The Anubis Gates. And at the same time, I mailed off my novel, The Digging Leviathan. We had the same editor at Tor Books, Beth Meacham. And Beth called on the telephone and said, look, you know, you got a character with the same name as Powers' character, and Powers' book takes place in 1811, and yours takes place in 1956. So what's the deal? And I said, I said, that's just a quirk. We'll change the name of my poet. I don't need the name William Ashbless. We'll give it to Tim. And she said, no, it's obvious the same guy. There's all kinds of textual evidence that it's got to be the same guy, and it's simply a time travel thing. And I thought, wow, you know, she's apparently correct. So we both got to use William Ashbless, and then he's been mentioned in a number of our books since. So it's been a lot of fun. There's even an international William Ashbless Society. God knows who set it up, but I think for a fee you can join. And he's written a cookbook and poetry and short stories and things since then. He writes, provocative introductions to our work or essays about our writing in which he condemns us both and threatens to beat us up and on occasion has beaten us up. So that's a lot of fun, you know.
Now, that business of going back and forth to write a poem collaboratively sounds to me like The Exquisite Corpse. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but it comes out of, I believe, the Dadaists, kind of a stream. I'm just wondering if you reinvented that technique independently or if you were aware of that at the time.
I was unaware of it. Tim might have been. I'm not sure. Tim's immensely widely read. Heaven knows. Nowadays, it's interesting to read. Sometimes I read poems that are largely incomprehensible and suspect that the writer was writing the piece in some way Ashbless style, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, you know, it can't just be the two of us who've done this sort of thing.
Right. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think what was funny about it was that a great number of people have taken it seriously over the years. And in fact, I used to get fan letters in which people would say that they'd gone down to the library to research William Ashbless and couldn't find a whole lot. Wonder if I could steer them towards something good. And it's like, sorry, you know, sorry I wasted your time.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, we just heard your story, The Pink of Faded Neon. Could you tell us, how did that come about?
Yeah, that was actually the third short story that I wrote that was published. So I was a very new writer at the time. Mm. And my wife and I were living up in Humboldt County in the city of Eureka, Northern California, which is a very almost weirdly green, foggy, wet, strange place. It's it immediately puts you in mind of something Lovecraftian, if you see what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Gigantic orange newts and banana slugs and God knows what all.
I'm sorry, did you say gigantic newts?
Newts, yeah.
So that's sort of like jumbo shrimp.
yeah, a little bit. In fact, I remember coming out outside one morning. I'm a big newt fan, and maybe they're salamanders. I'm not sure what the difference is, but
you're the first person ever to tell me that those words. So I just make note of that right here.
Well, they're actually fan. Yeah, they're wonderful little guys. Anyway, I walked out, and there on the front path down to the street, there was a salamander, a newt that was bright orange that, man, I don't know, it had to be 10 inches long. Heavy, heavy thing. Anyway, it was that kind of place. And my wife and I one night had gone, walked across town to eat dinner with a couple of good friends of ours who had, it was in the early 1970s and during the pretty bad recession in those days. Mm-hmm. And we had no money, and our friends had even less money, and because they had less money than we had, they qualified for food stamps, which meant they had better food. And so we'd gone over there because they had gotten cheese and a couple of other things. We thought, hot dog, we'll go eat, you know. We're walking home very late at night, and the fog was very dense, kind of blowing in and out. And we walked past a liquor store that had a pink neon sign out. I think it was Harris and E Liquors. And it was kind of glowing through the fog, and I thought, well, that's just cool, you know. And heaps of my work has been suggested by setting over the years, and I think that was some of the first of it that really was a setting piece more than anything else. And then the fog blew away, and in this empty field stood a water tower, very much like something you'd imagine out of War of the Worlds, you know.
Yes.
And in an Airstream trailer sitting beneath it in the weeds. And that was all that was in this lot. And then the fog blew back in, and we couldn't see it anymore, and home we went. And then once or twice in the months that followed, we saw what was apparently that same Airstream trailer sort of disappearing down alleys and parked on lonely stretches of beach, that sort of thing. Mm. And so I was simply inspired one day to to sort of write a story that was almost entirely shooting from the hip. I didn't plan any of it. The first story I'd ever written where I entirely trusted to language, I suppose, to carry me to some ultimate end. And I was really quite happy with the result. It was certainly by far the best thing I'd ever written up until that point. And I'll even go out on a limb and say that it's one of my better stories in its weird way. But I sent it off to, it might have been Isaac Asimov's magazine, which was edited at the time by George Sithers, if I'm not mistaken. And I got a rejection letter back condemning it for being, I don't know what, it was condemned, put it that
You're
way.
You're kidding. More than a polite no thanks?
Yeah, because it had this, it doesn't really have a plot when you get right down to it, except for in some weird sense, although I can think of Lovecraft stories that didn't have plots except in some weird sense.
Yeah, sure.
And it was, the language was strange and kind of fragmented here and there, you know. The editor simply wasn't keen on stories that weren't traditional stories.
Sure.
And I had been collecting rejection slips for years, so it was water off a duck. And I put it back in the mail and sent it to a literary magazine called Tri-Quarterly, which had a fairly big reputation, much bigger than I knew. I sent it to Tri-Quarterly because it was one of the literary magazines listed in Writer's Market that actually paid money for pieces, and that's what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I got a fairly quick acceptance letter and a check for $150 in the mail. And I thought that goes to show you know, one editor's meat is another editor's poison when you get right down to it.
Right.
And it was kind of heartening. And then in the weeks that followed the publication of the magazine, I actually got a couple of calls from literary agents. And that was I got my first agent that way.
Mm-hmm.
Who negotiated the sale of my first novel, The Elfin Ship. And we stayed together for, I don't know, several years. So a guy named Andrew Wiley, who became sort of infamous as a sort of shark literary agent. He's Salman Rushdie's agent now, and he was Allen Ginsberg's agent.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, he got to a point where I don't think he needed me very badly as a writer. And at that point, around the time that I wrote The Last Coin in the mid-1980s, I shifted agents to Writer's House in New York. But it was all, I guess writing The Pink of Fading Neon was turned out to be something that changed my entire writing life for the better. It's one of the most, in that sense, one of the most vital stories to my writing career that, you know, mm-hmm. that I wrote over the years.
Yeah, my reaction was you populated that story with mundane objects. Maybe a person of average attentiveness would say, yeah, they're kind of seedy, maybe a little melancholy, but you've really put on a writer's workshop in that story on how to take ordinary things and build something, create quite an astonishing effect in just a few words there. So,
well, thank you very much.
If you had sent it to me, I would. In fact, you did send it to me, now that I think of it. And we ran it here. How do your young people who want to write, how are they doing, and how do you help them?
Yeah, so teaching writing is a very interesting thing, because if young writers have this passion, this hot inspiration, and they just want to pick up the pen and go, it seems to me that it's the worst thing in the world to try to subvert that and insist that they outline, that they plot, that they not write this way, but write that way, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, to try to shift them out of the fast lane can be very damaging.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it is true that there's a craft at work, and that the sooner they begin to see the craft, the sooner they'll begin to get the kind of control over their work that allows them to write things that other people want to read, and not simply to, you know, write from inspiration in a way that re-inspires themselves but nobody else. And so I see it as being a very complicated, contradictory business all the way around. It's tough, you know, to say that you're teaching somebody to write. I think we, in many ways, we learn to write by reading and by writing and by experiencing the world, and it takes time to do. I hope that I've got a few things to say to students that accelerate the process or open their eyes to elements of the craft that they weren't seeing before. Mm-hmm. I haven't gotten a lot of complaints from students in that regard, and they sure don't complain about Tim's teaching, I can tell you that. He's remarkably highly thought of at the school. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it works, but that's a real learning process. It was strange to shift from university teaching to high school teaching. I put together this creative writing program at the Orange County School of the Arts in 2000, which meant that I was close to 13 years younger than I am today. And I had been teaching at the university for over 20 years, or colleges and universities for over 20 years, and I had to get used to the idea that high school students, especially artistic, talented high school students, have a lot of artistic energy that that will fade over the next few years, you know. So I walked into a classroom not quite knowing what I'd find, but mm-hmm. but it's been a real blast, you know. Been a real blast. You hope that you inspire them to do good work as much, I think, as teach them the craft, such as it is.
A bit of a balancing act, then? Inspiration and craft, then?
Yeah. Sometimes, a writer doesn't think about the craft too much when the writer is writing. The craft sort of becomes part of the whole cast of their mind. Mm-hmm. And in fact, not sound like too much of a teacher, but I'm a big fan of a Southern writer named Flannery O'Connor. And she said that as writers work, they develop the habit of the art. And I think that that's entirely true. And I think that 15-year-olds haven't developed the habit yet, with capital H, and the habit and the craft being the same thing. And I don't think you can push it any faster than it wants to develop naturally without putting them completely off the whole business, you know.
My motives are somewhat selfish for asking this question because my daughter's 11 and she just about a week ago finished a story. It was the first story she had written that she was willing to let me see.
Well,
so I struggled to know what to say to her.
I think that I'd say, oh my gosh, that's great. You know, write some more. I love this. I love that. And I might be wrong in that regard. I wrote my first story when I was 10 or 11. And, I'd been hanging out with a friend of mine. We were walking down the railroad tracks, which is something we used to do pretty much every day back in those days. And he was telling me that he'd just seen a film called Macabre. And I thought, well, that's a great title, because I pictured it as being spelled M-C, capital C-O-B. Like,
I see. Yes.
Yeah, and I pictured a walking skeleton smoking a corncob pipe. And I was very excited. I thought, man, I got to see that film. I completely misunderstood, you know, what he was talking about. And I went home and wrote a short story in which a walking skeleton in a top hat and smoking a pipe terrorizes a family in a farmhouse, appearing in the windows, running around, you know, shouting. How, you know, I have no idea how skeletons can shout, but this one did. And, you know, it had no motivation whatsoever to be doing this. I had no idea what the skeleton thought he was up to. Unlike zombies, it didn't want to eat people or anything, you know. And it didn't have any craft to it, I can tell you that. And I don't remember enough about it even to know whether I could put the words together well in those days. Mm-hmm. But it but writing it, the very act of writing it, made me sort of fall in love with the whole business of writing. And, you know, one thing led to another after that. It would have had a negative effect on me, maybe a killing effect, if I had showed it to somebody who lectured me about motivation or in characters or something like that, you know.
Right.
I think I turned it into a class that I was in, although I'm not positive. I might have been too shy to have done that. But yeah, blessedly I was preserved anybody's opinion. And I think because of that, I simply could be stoked about the whole business of writing the thing and go ahead and write another, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a pulp fiction podcast, and most of the time our attention is focused on the classic era of 60 to 80 years ago, or even longer. But we are on the lookout for modern authors that have some kind of connection, and certainly someone might argue that steampunk is has inherited the pulp tradition. How would you describe your relationship to pulp fiction, if you have one? Are you comfortable in admitting, fessing up to that sort of thing?
Yeah. You know, I went through a period, when I read all the Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard and the Edgar Rice Burroughs I could get my hands on. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm sitting here in my study now looking at, collected, Clark Ashton Smith and, Lovecraft and heaps of pulp stuff. I was very affected by it, loved it then, and I love it now. Unfortunately, well, put it this way, I'm quite happy that I read most of that stuff when I was younger, because some of the line-by-line writing is perhaps not as, doesn't seem as good to me today as it did back then.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I don't have as much interest in, I don't know what, barbarians wielding swords today that I had when I was 15 or 18 or whatever it might happen to be. But I was really very much affected by any story that had to do with a lurking menace, you know, that Lovecraftian thing where one of his characters begins to understand that there's really something very terrible happening.
Mm-hmm.
Love that kind of thing. Those stories, I think, were highly atmospheric. Some of Lovecraft's are just stunningly atmospheric, and
yeah.
I've always been a fan of that. I think that's what made the Sherlock Holmes stories so affecting to me when I was, you know, a kid and first started reading those. You know, it was the atmosphere that I was reacting to, and I think that I came to have a very high regard for setting in a story, just about as high a regard for setting as for character. And in fact, I think that when I write, I very often think, what would this character do set loose in this particular setting? Character and setting always seem to me to be tied up together. And I'm not sure that's true of all. In fact, I'm sure it's not true of many writers. I think I was probably infected with a love of setting, at least partly by reading the, you know, pulpy stuff. Although, equally by reading Steinbeck and Mark Twain and other, you know, setting-heavy writers. I loved it all.
Mm-hmm.
Mixed it up together. And I think all of it is still sort of what in my blood.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wish I had more of an, was more of an omnivore. I wasted my teen years on, seems like it was Asimov and a little bit of Heinlein, which I find kind of regrettable. And I admire anyone who has the ambition to read very widely like that.
Well, yeah, I just never distinguished between one or the other. I was happy enough reading. I didn't catch on to contemporary science fiction until I was in college.
Oh, that's interesting.
I grew up on Verne and Wells and Burroughs, and actually thought they were science fiction, because I had never read anything more contemporary. And then I was, when I guess I was 19 or 20, and I took a class at Cal State Fullerton. This was right before I met Tim. I took a class in science fiction and was shocked to discover that I'd never heard of any of the titles at all that I was being asked to read. And, you know, I read Dune and Canticle for Leibowitz and Left Hand of Darkness and this whole, you know, catalog of absolutely brilliant stuff, which I then began to binge on for years after that. But it was a big shock to me. I thought, wait, how did I miss this? Yeah, I was busy reading other things, you know. But yeah, that was the way it was. It seems almost, I don't know what, contrary to reason that, you know, could have been the case, but it was. I think part of the business had to do with my having grown up reading in a sort of vacuum. My sister was also a big reader, but I started out reading the books that were in my mother's library. She had several shelves of books.
Oh, yes.
And including Steinbeck and Conan Doyle and, I don't know, Poe. Read a lot of Poe. My sister, my mother started hauling us both down to the library when she figured out we were readers. And that's where I started checking out Vernon Wells and Burroughs and Howard Pease, who was a seafaring writer. And my sister, she was a big Black Stallion fan, and she convinced me to read The Black Stallion, which I figured was a girly book. I didn't want to. But I went crazy for that, too. Read all of those. And still have a whole set on a shelf in my house. But, you know, it was the books that were we brought home from the library and that were in my house that I cut my teeth on. And then when I was in high school, I read everything I was asked to read, but none of it was science fiction. And I also read what I darn well wanted, even at the expense of some of the things I was supposed to read. But as I say, I guess when I got into, I just never known that there was this whole subgenre of, or this whole genre of science fiction and fantasy out there. Too bad, because I would have loved a whole lot of it when I was 15, you know, but I was reading other stuff I loved when I was 15, so what the heck. Yeah.
Well, the tragedy is there's not enough time to read it all, and I guess there's probably not a reader on earth who can't list dozens of titles that they haven't got around to. And it only gets worse over time.
It does get worse. It gets worse for a number of reasons, one of which is that I think a person's tastes tend to narrow a little bit over time as they get older, you know. And there are things that we simply have no interest in reading that at another time in our life we might have really enjoyed. But such is life, you know.
Yes. And there's too many good writers working today, too, I think.
There are. Yeah. In fact, not to switch up the subject, but I was a judge for the World Fantasy Award last year.
Mm-hmm.
And,
that's interesting.
Yeah, boy, I was entirely sober when I agreed to be a judge for the World Fantasy Award. And it wasn't until, I don't know, the books started to arrive, books and magazines, in January, I guess. And after I don't know, 50 or 60 books showed up, I thought, well, that's probably the bulk of it. and then it just sort of accelerated. And finally, I was down the street and found at a garage sale a bookcase that was cheap. And I brought it home solely to hold books, you know, that I was considering for the World Fantasy Award. And it became clear that it was probably 3 feet wide and 4 shelves high, about a foot deep, so I could stack them in 2 deep. And by April it was full and the books were piling up on the floor. That was interesting, but it opened my eyes to the vast number of really fine writers out there. It was really difficult to say, well, this book is worthy of an award and this book is not. And in fact, it was interesting to see how many just exceedingly competent writers there are out there publishing kind of humbling, I guess. Mm-hmm. I had determined that I hated vampire stories and zombie stories. But, you know, I mean, if you're giving out awards, you got to read what they send you. And lo and behold, I found vampire stories and zombie stories that were really good, you know. Mm-hmm. And, it just alerted me to the fact that in any given year, there's a ton of really fine stuff being published. And we can hardly regret what we don't have time to read, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I've become aware that apparently a zombie erotica has become a very hot subgenre. And boy.
Well, I heard that there's steampunk porn being written, which is kind of appalling to think of. But anyway.
There's a law of the internet that covers that, I think. But speaking of people mailing you books, I should publicly thank you for that. We were able to read your story, Pink of Fade Neon, because you very generously mailed me a copy of your volume 13 Phantasms, which is a collection of stories. And I told you the story, but I'll repeat it briefly. The book arrived on the 24th of December in a package, and my wife asked me, did not want to tell me what the contents was in case it was a birthday gift for me from one of my relatives. And I said, well, no, I don't think I ordered anything, so it must be a gift. So she wrapped your book and put it under the Christmas tree. And it was the biggest surprise out of all the Christmas gifts I received this year. So thank you again one more time for sending me that.
I was happy. It's a pretty funny story, actually. if I would have been thinking, you know, I would have said it was from Uncle Bill or something. Confounded you, I was happy to send it. The story's it's not all that easy to find anymore. Mm-hmm. Although now that I think of it, it's probably, I don't know if it is available electronically. Probably not. God knows where you would have found it if I hadn't sent you a copy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate it. We have had you for quite a while now, and thank you for that. And I should probably let you go soon, but we definitely don't want you to leave without telling us about your new novel, which is The Aylesford Skull.
Yeah.
And that's, they're saying that's a steampunk.
Is that right? It's as steampunk as it can conceivably be. It's the longest novel I've written, and I think the most, what do I want to say, has a fairly quick pace. And a bunch of characters who I'm really quite fond of, small characters that kind of take on a life of their own in the novel and kind of surprise me to a degree. But anyway, it's being published on the 15th of this month, which is pretty doggone close, by Titan Books of New York and London. It'll come out in both the British Isles and North America pretty much at the same time. In fact, I'm starting off on what the publisher is referring to as a blog tour. I'm not quite sure what that's going to amount to, but I've been writing two or three interviews a month or a week for the last several weeks, going to various blog sites and magazines and stuff like that, and to chat about the book and about my career and all. It's been really very exciting. It was just recommended by Barnes & Noble as one of the picks of the month, so that was cool. Hope people enjoy it when they read it.
Without spoiling anything, can you tell us specifically, tease us with a few of the specific steampunk elements?
Okay, well, it's set in 1883 in London, and in my main character, Professor Langdon St. Ives, who's been a series character for me since my second published story back in the early 70s, or mid-70s, I should say. He's living in Kent, having retired from adventures because he's pretty tired. He's got two kids now. And a series of terrible things begins to happen involving river pirates and opened graves and kidnappings and he's drawn into a very dangerous, what becomes an enormous plot that threatens the very existence of London. But it's got dirigible activity and
good.
Yeah.
Airships. Yeah,
explosions. Yeah, it's a very active book. It's certainly the most active book I've ever written. I'm hoping that it's true that once readers get going in it, they'll keep going in it. It's getting very nice reviews preliminarily, so I've got high hopes for it. I also had as long as we're still in the air, I've recently published a young adult novel that I'm also pretty doggone happy with.
Yeah, tell us about that.
It's a thing called Zooglodon, The True Adventures of Kathleen Perkins, Cryptozoologist. A Zooglodon being a wonky-looking dinosaur that's kind of a cross between a Tyrannosaurus Rex and a Plesiosaur. But it's the first of what I anticipate to be a series of adventure novels starring an 11-year-old girl named Kathleen Perkins, who's very spunky and sprightly and is an amateur cryptozoologist. I'm anticipating that the several novels in the series, knock on wood that I managed to sell these things as they are written, will have to do with a different genre of adventure novel, let's say, kind of an old-fashioned business. The first one is essentially a Hollow Earth book, and the second I see as a kind of a desert island adventure.
Yes.
There's going to be a haunted house adventure.
As I mentioned, my daughter is 11, so it sounds like that would be perfect for her.
It's custom built for her, although yeah. I think that older readers can enjoy it also. The language is accessible, but not in any sense dumbed down. Mm-hmm. And many people, including myself, are not necessarily happy with terms like young adult because it seems to exclude other readers. And it also seems to be contrived for young adult readers. And neither of those things is true of this book, I think. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I'm quite happy with it.
Well, I think the dirty little secret, well, it's hardly dirty, but the open secret is that there are an awful lot of adults who are reading YA novels. So,
yeah,
I can't imagine very many people are going to be scared away by that.
No, I hope they're not. It was published by Subterranean Press and it's available, as an ebook. I'm hoping that it finds a commercial paperback publisher in the not too distant future.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's out there. And then I also just finished another steampunk adventure for Subterranean Press called The Pagan Goddess, which is an indescribable book involving, I can't even say what it involves because it would give too much away. I'm not quite sure when that'll come out. I just delivered it about a week ago, actually. Just sent off the signed contract today, so it'll be off. It'll be out. I don't know. Probably maybe in the fall of the year. So there's a certain amount of stuff being generated from downtown Orange these days. Which is where I live, by the way.
Yes.
Great.
Well, I guess we should wrap it up. And on behalf of Dave Robison and all the listeners of Protecting Project Pulp, I'd like to thank you, Jim, very, very much for spending time with us and telling us what you're up to.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on the air, and thanks for all your listeners for listening. I hope they enjoyed it.
James, I think I speak for all our listeners in assuring you that enjoyment was the least of the emotions we experienced during this fabulous discussion. These opportunities are rare and wonderful things, and we really appreciate it. And speaking of rare and wonderful, Protecting Project Pulp is brought to you each week by a team of rare and wonderful and talented individuals. Fred Heimbaugh is our editor. interviewer also, and seeker of awesomeness, tracking down exquisite tales of pulpy wonder through the literary wilderness. Tom O'Dwyer is our sound engineer, whose mad skills with a wave file have been compared to Rumpelstiltskin spinning straw into auditory gold. And Tony Smith is our producer and fearless leader, the captain of this mad ship of fabulous fiction, piloting us to unknown shores and exotic ports of call. Now, remember, gang, there's no need to go beachcombing on the shores of madness to gather up your weekly ration of awesome pulp tales. Just navigate yourself to iTunes and subscribe to us there. You can also seek harbor at our website, www.protectingprojectpulp.com, and check out all our episodes there, as well as leave a comment on the posts or in our forums. Well, friends, next week will be my final episode as your host, and we wanted to make sure it was a good one. Now, for me personally, nothing says pulp like a good Robert E. Howard story. And we'll be pulling one of his more rough-and-tumble tales from the PPP archives titled Waterfront Fists. And gang, don't sweat it. A successor has been chosen to continue the tradition of bringing you delicious pulp tales each week. And you know, we'll share some of those details next week as well. But until then, I'm your host, Dave Robison, wishing you nothing but the finest adventures. We'll see you next week. This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.